the great labor historian E.P. Thompson says you always have to have at least two to make a class, and you can't have a class without workers and bosses. But the middle class is in a funny position with that.
They actually had a Mother Jones injunction, so it was also actually called that. Let's get rid of these agitators, and she's the most dangerous agitator.
How did politicians get obsessed with saving the middle class, and when did middle class become just white guys while the economy increasingly failed to work for the diverse working class? We'll find out this week when the Heartland Labor Forum radio show talks with KU historian David Roediger, who explains in his new book, The Sinking Middle Class. The Heartland Labor Forum also pays homage to the most iconic woman leader in labor history. Labor historian Rosemary Foyer invites us to help spread the legacy of Mother Jones. Heartland Labor Forum is Kansas City's only radio program about the workplace, produced by and for working people. The show has been agitating on the air since 1989 and is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. On this week's Labor History in 2, A Chain Reaction of Human Misery. I'm Chris Garlock, and that's all ahead on this week's Labor History Today. I hope you enjoy the show.
March, can be one, many stones can form an arch, singly done, and by union what we will.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight on the show, how did politicians get obsessed with saving the middle class, and when did the middle class become just white guys, while the economy increasingly failed to work for the diverse working class? We'll talk to KU historian David Roediger, who explains this in his new book called The Sinking of the Middle Class. Then, we'll pay homage to the most iconic woman leader in labor history and talk to labor historian Rosemary Foyer, who is inviting you to help spread the legacy of Mother Jones.
With the fish and rock, another day on the dock so high, but the water's running cold. Fish have all been fished up here, slot ones long ago disappeared. None of these straits are paved with gold. My grandpa, he's a working man, still provides whenever he can. But today he just explodes. It's the same old story we've all been told. The rich get richer and we just get old. It's the same old lesson we've never learned. The play with fire and you won't get burned. But we'll outlast them in this fight. Well, they can't stand too long out in the light. Cause the fish
and that's George Mann with his brand new album, and the song is called The Fish Always Rots from the Head. It's very political. I'm Judy Ansel. David Roediger is Foundation Distinguished Professor of American Studies and History at the University of Kansas. His teaching history is like a tour of Midwestern universities, starting with Northwestern and including the University of Missouri-Columbia, the University of Minnesota, the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. His books center on labor history, the construction of racial identity, and the intersection of class and race. Some of them, there are many, include The Wages of Whiteness, Seizing Freedom, Slave Emancipation and Liberty for All, How Race Survived U.S. History, From Settlement and Slavery to the Obama Phenomenon, History Against Misery, and Working Toward Whiteness, How American Immigrants Became White, The Strange Journey from Ellis Island to the Suburbs. His new book is called The Sinking Middle Class, A Political History. It's just out and available from OR Books. Welcome to the show, David Roediger.
Hi, Judy. It's so great to be on.
Well, thank you again for being on. This isn't your first time on the Heartland Labor Forum. So
I think I've been on in four different decades now.
Well, just keep producing those books. Although we'd love to have you anytime, actually, because I really value your insights into what's going on in America. And I want to start by getting you to do a little definition about what middle class is and who you think is middle class. So just answer yes or no. Who's middle class? Barack Obama, who called himself a warrior for the middle class? Yes or no?
No.
Okay.
No.
My neighbor who works in an envelope factory?
No, probably.
Her supervisor?
Yes.
Okay, the 99%? That's
no.
A trick question.
Yeah.
How about you, a distinguished college professor?
I've always defined myself as working class.
Okay. Joe Biden? He also pledges to save the middle class. No, right?
He calls himself middle class Joe sometimes, or claims other people do, but I don't think so.
Okay. So do most workers think of themselves as middle class?
Well, that was one of the things I really learned from writing this book, is I had the kind of standard view that I think many of us have been around the labor movement and raised in the labor movement for a long time. We just kind of wish that people who were working class would use that label and not define themselves as middle class. And I came into the book thinking that. I came out of the book thinking that. But I did learn something about, I think that people adopt the term middle class for a lot of complicated reasons, some of which are quite understandable. One is, if you want to get a hearing from politicians in the United States, you couch your demands as middle class demands rather than as working class demands. And that has to do with the long history of repression of the left, and particularly the working class left in the United States. But another reason is that a lot of working people have problems that have long been associated with the middle class. The middle class had more access to credit and therefore had more problems with debt through U.S. history. Now some working class people also share those problems with debt. And also long hours because of lack of overtime protections. Middle managers in particular often work excruciatingly long hours. That's become a working class phenomenon as well, sometimes in two or three jobs. And then middle class people, particularly office workers and sales workers, have through the last 100 years been managed according to their personalities and been disciplined at work or are unsuccessful at work if their personalities weren't saleable. And that's also a way that almost all working people are managed now, that you have to be positive and happy. And the scientific managers, the factory managers used to only care if you could lift that amount or keep the assembly line moving. But now a big component of all management is management of the worker's personality. So I do understand why some working class people think, oh, I have these problems that have long been thought of as middle class problems.
So can you then define briefly what the difference is between being working class and middle class? How do you define them?
Well, it's a tricky question, because working class actually is, in material terms, a class relationship. Some people own things where other people work. And so the people who go to those job sites and manage other people's labor are the people who benefit because they own those workplaces, are in a different class from working class people who have to go to work at those places in order to survive. There's no such material relationship associated with being middle class. Middle class is all sorts of different things that have been ideologically cobbled together to make people believe that they're part of this whole. The most famous U.S. book on the middle class is a book called White Collar by the sociologist C. Wright Mills. And you get to the very end of it, and he says, well, actually, but there's not really such a thing as a middle class. It's a mystification. And a little bit, you get to the end of my book and you think, well, it's not a class in the way that, say, Marxists think about class, because it's people who are in all sorts of different relationships and have different interests, class interests, society.
So if middle class is an unintelligible grouping of a lot of different people, why is it that the Democrats and the Republicans are always talking about saving them?
Well, in part because the way that the Democrats and Republicans define the middle class is so expansive that if you won the middle class, you couldn't possibly lose it would be almost impossible to lose an election. When Romney and Obama ran against each other in 2012, they both said the middle class was everybody who makes less than $250,000 a year. Romney sometimes said $300,000 a year. Well, that was 96-97% of the population. So if you're a pollster and you say all we have to do is win the middle class, that's just, it's obvious it's also empty. Mm. You're saying almost the whole population is middle class, including the 20% of the people who are below the poverty line during that election. So Obama got asked about that, and he said, well, those 20% are aspirationally middle class. So wow. Part of the definition of middle class sometimes is that people get to decide if they're in it, no matter what their income and wealth and position on the job is. So if you believe that, you get to quit talking about the poor as a specific problem. You can, our working people as a specific problem. You can just lump together this great mass of the population and say, I'm their savior.
Right. Yeah. And of course, in your book, you spend a lot of time talking about the evolution of this, because our political leaders didn't always talk in terms of saving the middle class. And you talk about a pollster named Stanley Greenberg, who had an outsized influence over the Democratic Party strategies starting in the 1990s, and especially over Bill Clinton. Why is he important?
Well, what Greenberg did, his early career was as a radical academic at Yale, and then he found his way into Democratic Party polling and strategy. And what he did in the wake of the Reagan victories and the first Bush victory was to go to a white working class county outside of Detroit called Macomb County, automobile workers, tank producers. And he convinced the Democrats that he could teach them, based on polling in that county, how to get these Reagan Democrats, working class people who always voted Democrat, now voted for Reagan. He could get them back into the fold of the Democratic Party. And this was a time when the Democrats had very little to offer trade union workers, either in the way of labor law are in the way of trade policy. It was a time of support for NAFTA by the Clintons. But what he did, based on these polls in Macomb County, he said that the main thing about these white workers, who he called middle class, and he sometimes called themselves middle class, the main thing about them is how reactionary they were in terms of racial politics and gender politics. So you couldn't give them much in class terms, in union terms, but you certainly could say, we promise not to go too far on racial justice. We promise to, as Clinton said, end affirmative action and welfare as we know it, mend affirmative action in a way that reined it in considerably, the Effective Death Penalty Act, all these Mandatory Sentences Act, the crack cocaine penalties, all of those things, the end of busing and active school integration, all of those issues, taxes, that were racially inflected, Greenberg says, if you can respect the white working class, what he called the middle class, by simply attending to their racial politics and not attending to their class politics.
And of course, Joe Biden supported all that in the Senate, right?
Yes, and sometimes claims to have written the 1994 crime bill.
Right. So I... So basically what you're saying is that the Democrats went for this code of middle class, which basically dropped out the issues of minorities and women in their party platforms and what they stood for. I want to quote from an essay you wrote in New Politics in August. You comment that class is meaningless without relationship to other classes. You can't have, for instance, you can't have lower without upper, for example. Then you say, quote, what then of the middle class? Who's their other? Those in the middle can look up or down to find an adversary or see themselves as perpetually ground between others. When political parties agree that the thriving of those at the top is key to a sound economy, saving the middle class channels complaints towards the supposed government largesse towards unionized workers, the poor, and especially the racialized poor. This is really what your criticism is of the Democrats, isn't it? That their strategy essentially is racist and divides our vast working class?
I think that's right. The great labor historian E.P. Thompson says you always have to have at least two to make a class. And he said you can't have love without lovers. You can't have a class without workers and bosses. But the middle class is in a funny position with that because it could look up, and sometimes when we hear about populism, at some points in history, the middle class has looked up to find its others, its enemies. But mostly, especially if politicians encourage this, it's easier to look down and to find scapegoats who are immigrants, who are black, who are poor people in general. And so the middle class participates in not only the erasing of racial issues and social justice issues around race, but also it kind of elbows class off the table. If that's all the more that the Democrats have to do in order to satisfy white working class demands, then you won't get labor law reform, for example.
Yeah, right. So it seems, though, that the labor movement has adopted the same language. I mean, they don't use the word working class anymore. They're scared to use it. They're afraid they're going to get red-baited. And so they adopted middle class, too. When did that happen?
I think it probably happened in the 90s in a decisive sort of way. The Clinton election in 92 is the election in which the Democrats began to use middle class in a wholesale way. Middle class had been a term that became popular during the Cold War. The kind of what was great about America term was that it was a middle class society. But neither political party tried to use it very much until the 90s. And then I think trailing the Democratic political leaders, trade union leaders also started to use that term as to describe. So, for example, the Right to Work failed campaign in Michigan recently, the unions fought that campaign in the name of defending the middle class, mm-hmm. not defending workers.
They did it here in Missouri, too.
Yeah, with a better result.
Yeah, right. So, and what I've always felt, and just tell me if you agree, is that when labor uses the term middle class, they're basically saying to poor workers that you're not part of us and we don't need to pay attention to you. And of course, the vast majority of unorganized workers are poor workers. And so it just seems to me to be very exclusive.
Kind of sits very uneasily against the fight for 15, for example.
Right.
Organizing workers who are right at the poverty line, and then the labor leadership is talking about the defending the middle class. And then a lot of people who are in the labor movement for most of their lives have fallen out of the middle class as well. The labor writer Harold Meyerson in the last election predicted that neither party would use middle class. He was wrong. But he was kind of trying to anticipate that so many people, say, had a trade union job, solidly a working class job, and were making $35 an hour and could kind of convince themselves that that was a middle class job. They got downsized out of that job, and now they work at Home Depot. They're mm-hmm. called a manager. And they make $12
right.
an hour. So their terminology becomes very, very confused.
Yeah, that's for sure. Okay, we've only got 2 minutes left, and I do want to ask you, because you spent so much time dealing with issues of race and in the working class. What are your thoughts about labor's reaction to the Black Lives Matter movement?
Well, I'm disappointed, of course, that there hasn't been more of a reaction. I was mostly at the Black Lives Matter protests around Mike Brown's murder in St. Louis and at the Ferguson ones. And it's not that there were no unions there. In particular, of course, the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists always had delegations, and Fight for 15 had delegations. But for the main body of the labor movement, they didn't feel like they had to be there.
Right.
And it turns out that they really did have to be there. And that it sort of goes back to the thrust of this book, is that, you know, as long as we have this division that allows us to think that reparations aren't a working class issue, or that police brutality directed against young black and brown men is not a working class issue, it's going to be easy to weaken the labor movement too. So at some point, out of self-interest, I do think that the labor leadership might come around to strongly supporting movements for racial justice. The question is, will they be so weak by then in terms of their own membership and power that it doesn't mean very much that they do?
Well, we're going to have to end it on that and have you back. The book is called The Sinking Middle Class, A Political History. Our guest is David Roediger. You can find the book on the webpage of OR Press. Thank you so much, David.
Thanks. It's always great to talk to you.
Bye.
One time, Mother Jones was out in Colorado at the great Ludlow strike. Now, that was a strike to enforce the 8-hour day, which the state of Colorado had made a law, but they couldn't enforce it because Rockefeller owned the militia. Now, the governor promised not to send the militia into the coal fields, but he lied, and he did. Mother Jones was in the Union Hall down there at Ludlow, and word came that the militia had entered the coal fields. Well, she leapt up, and she screamed, "Let's go get the sons of bitches!" And she stormed out. She didn't look to see if anybody was following her. Nobody was following her. She just flounced up the road alone and confronted the militia. And that was the year that President Theodore Roosevelt called Mother Jones the most dangerous woman in America. And she was 83 years old. That's some kind of dangerous.
Welcome back to the Heartland Labor Forum. I am your host, Michael Savoie. Our show tonight is titled Mother Jones, Her Monuments and Museums. Our musical prelude was the legendary Utah Phillips version of The Most Dangerous Woman. My guest is Rosemary Fourier, director of the Mother Jones Heritage Project. Hello, Rosemary. Thank you for joining us on the Heartland Labor Forum.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, indeed. You know, it's been said that those who forget their history are condemned to repeat it. I don't know who said it, Rosemary, but I am certain that we, the working class of America, have never known our history. Could you give us a little historic overlight of who Mary Harris Jones was?
Absolutely. She was the dynamic organizer of the early 20th century for the labor movement. Upton Sinclair, for instance, said of her that wherever she went, the flame of protest leaped in the hearts of men. Her story was a veritable odyssey of revolt. So, you know, this is Upton Sinclair, who wrote The Jungle and who was later on socialist candidate for governor of California, but mostly known as a writer. And he knew her and knew of her times. And so when we remember her, we remember the way that people fought back, you know, in what I call an age of violence, when brute force was used to keep workers from organizing. She was fearless. She was an Irish immigrant, really a refugee from the famine in Great Britain, which was, or I'm sorry, in Ireland, that was imposed by Great Britain because there was food that was available to feed people, but they chose to export it. And Ireland, you know, her experience and her family's experience in Ireland kind of primed her for a revolt as well. But then, you know, she lost her family in her young children and her husband, who was a union organizer in Memphis, Tennessee. And so she was a person who experienced not only the loss of famine, but the loss of her entire expectations and her livelihood and her precious children and husband, then came up to Chicago and experienced yet shortly thereafter in 1871, the Great Fire of, you know, Chicago that just devastated the working class community there. And it was there in the midst of the embers of and smoke, literally, that she found her comrades. She found her a heart to continue on in trying to mobilize people to protest. And she said that, you know, in that moment, she began to think about how she could contribute to changing that brutish civilization. So her experience with famine and with terrible losses and tragedy steeled her and made her, I think, capable of facing down bayonets and facing down a brutish force-based civilization in that time.
Indeed, hardship always in struggle creates the very best of us. I'm reminded that labor activists are not born, they're actually created by the tyranny of the capitalist class. And so that's how she became a labor activist and agitator, right? She was just kind of honed by the pressures of the times. Could you elaborate?
Well, this was a time of, as I said, brute force. But Chicago was also a place that labor rebellion was occurring. And being part of that, I think, shaped her identity, being part of a community of struggle. So she never really was an individual who was great on her own. She always credited learning from people who in other traditions. And in 1890, she became part of the unemployed movement. And there was an unemployed movement that was connected, and we usually call it, think of it as Coxey's Army, these, you know, this iconoclastic individual who took up, you know, a group of men who passed across the United States and tried to march on Washington for the first time. It was the first march on Washington for jobs and to, you know, for the government to do something about the unemployed move, the unemployment situation, and to create jobs. They had a program for good roads. Well, people forget that there were women involved in this too, and women did try to join it. She was one of the more prominent women. She marched, by the way, all the way through from California. Well, they also commandeered trains or took trains. It's quite a jaunt, right? But, you know, she got people out of prison. She went through Kansas and Missouri and tried to, you know, they were really met with terrible oppression in that movement. And that also shaped her. In fact, that's when she started taking on the name of Mother Jones in that unemployed demonstration.
Mm-hmm. You know, Rosemary, Mother Jones was best known for activism with minors. Mm-hmm. But much of her early work was done with the legendary Eugene V. Debs with the American Railroad Union. Could you tell our listeners a little about that?
And I think that was when she, you know, in that unemployed movement, it stopped in Chicago. She was from Chicago. She was moving to Chicago. And that's when she came in contact with Debs. And, of course, it overlaps with the Pullman strike. She later became an honorary member of the Chicago local. She worked and kept that movement alive when he was sent to jail. And, you know, this is, again, brute force, where they send in, you know, what they did was they attached mail cars to the Pullman cars to break that strike. And, you know, it's the government and corporate collusion, just as we're seeing today, you know, where you have a complete setup. And it was also conspiracy trials that had emanated from Haymarket. Haymarket in Chicago was an event for the eight-hour day, and they targeted anarchists and actually hung anarchists in order to stop that movement, and labeled the whole movement with anarchy and set up a conspiracy trial. As I said, Debs got caught up and ensnared in the conspiracy trials as well. And conspiracy has been used ever since, or had been used beginning with the Cord Rainers, to stop movement. So you really had no choice if you were an activist to say, how do we overcome this law? Pullman turned Debs into a socialist and Mother Jones into a socialist. So they came together into the socialist movement, which the radical and aims, which was, we have to overturn this entire brutish civilization. So, you know, that set Mother Jones on a course of the left wing of the labor movement, one where she starts to build people's courage and their determination to get rid of this judge-made law. You know, we're looking at a situation now where we're going to have a Supreme Court justice. They had an entire Supreme Court then that basically said labor needed to be swatted down every once in a while to put workers in their place. There was nothing else you could do but rise up. And she looked to the past of examples of street-based protest and said, you know, they're trying to keep us off the streets. We must take to the streets. And I think it's a message of how that is relevant now. You know, the ignoring the Supreme Court and just saying we have to make our own law and we have to be willing to fight back against this judge-made law.
Absolutely. You know, the tactics are more subtle today, but they're just as effective, perhaps, as they were then, mm-hmm. in terms of the brute force of the overseers. You know, it was reported that Teddy Roosevelt dubbed was the most dangerous woman in America. At the same time, United Mine Workers called her the miner's angel. Can you elaborate on that? Could both have been right?
Oh, I think so. I think that, you know, they actually had a Mother Jones injunction. So it was also actually called that. Let's get rid of these agitators wherever they're going. And she's the most dangerous agitator. But for miners, seeing this old woman who's willing to fight and, you know, who she was known as the miner's angel, not for her angelic behavior. And she didn't actually like the name angel because she said, I'm here for this world, not for the afterlife. And she got the name originally actually from being on the spot. She seemed to appear like an angel at the dangerous locations and facing down the bayonets. So that's the origins of the name. And she said, I'm no angel, but she liked the idea that she could appear anywhere and that she could steal people's determination. She also organized women in these areas as her army, you know, as the women's army, the mop and broom brigades, who would challenge the soldiers and the armed mercenaries to shoot her first, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that was something where here's this old woman willing to put herself in danger. Maybe I should consider that as a model. There were women who would write to the United Mine Workers Journal saying, oh, if I could just go and be Mother Jones and be brave enough to do this. You know, so there was an admiration and an inspiration there.
Indeed. You know, labor is most effective when its women are involved, its wives are involved. Tell me, Rosemary, how did Mother Jones inspire others to recognize their common interests across race and culture and in regional boundaries to build a formidable opposition to the bosses?
Yeah, I mean, we have to remember this is a time of extreme racial supremacy, and it also included a kind of grading of immigrants as good versus bad. Anybody who was, you know, could be labeled as a bad immigrant. And so she confronted that immediately when she went to West Virginia. She announced to the convention that she thought the African-American trade unionists were the best. And sort of to put anybody who had any reservations about where she stood in place, that they would be the base of organizing. And, you know, she struggled to overcome her own remnants of racism. And I think that she, you know, she was open about that. But, you know, when people would, she just basically preached that, you know, this racism is the mechanism of the ruling class to keep everyone in their place and to, you know, enable them to become the dominant class.
Absolutely. You know, it's amazing how we still haven't figured that out. You know, Mother Jones was, and still is for that matter, an inspiration to workers worldwide. The Fannie Sullins and the other labor activists that were taking the bull by the horns, in a sense, and making a difference.
Yeah, I think that her model inspired a number of women. She certainly inspired Fannie Sullins, and we are, our project is trying to get a marker to Fannie Sullins. This is, our project isn't about Mother Jones, but the people and her times, and thinking of her as a kind of founder of the modern American labor movement, somebody who deserves to be honored in that respect. But she did, I mean, when she went to, you know, there were multiple other women who credited all the way up, you know, when the New Deal got started, Frances Perkins, the Department of Labor, put a bust of Mother Jones front and center as, you know, the kind of founder of a decent program. It wasn't certainly workers' control, but it was a decent program for workers. So Fannie Sullins was really followed directly in her footsteps, organizing African-Americans, especially welcoming them into the movement instead of trying to stop, you know, stop them from taking jobs, just saying we need to open our doors to the labor movement more fully to African-Americans and recognize they'll make the best trade unionist. Mm-hmm. She died in 1919. Of course, at the hands of brutish mine guards in the Pennsylvania Coal and Iron Police. You know, so this public-private partnership is just one example. Really, policing in Pennsylvania is one example of what they faced, and she did give her life to the labor movement.
Yeah, we're still taking casualties, Rosemary.
Mm-hmm.
No question about that. We're down to our two-minute mark, so I wanted to talk a little bit about old Mother Jones was quoted as saying her home is where the struggle is. And of course, when there wasn't a struggle, and that wasn't very often, why, she did hang her hat in Chicago. Can you tell me about your effort to create a monument in downtown Chicago for Mother Jones?
Yeah, this was inspired by the idea that there are only two really representations of women on statues in Chicago. So even before the current issue about, you know, who is represented in a public sphere, we had started this campaign with the idea that she deserves to be there. She was inspired by Chicago, as I mentioned, and she inspired Chicagoans. And this was the base of her operations. She rarely rested. Her home was where the struggle was. But Chicago, by building this representation of workers, and I should say there are no statues of workers in Chicago either, you know, of any kind. And so it's really an abomination that we don't have that kind of representation. And I think that statues help us to remember who is important. And we are making the campaign with the support of the Irish Embassy, who has given us a starter grant. We need to raise funds, so I urge anybody who's interested to go to our website and find the statue campaign. Our website is motherjonesmuseum.org.
Yeah, I was going to get you to include that. I was very impressed with your website. Tell us in our last 30 seconds, Rosemary, about her internment and her monument there at Mount Olive in Illinois. Tell us about her internment there in Mount Olive, Illinois, and the monument that was her.
Yeah, she was buried in Mount Olive in the hopes that she would inspire ordinary workers. It was, you know, a very important mining town. It had given rise to a radical labor movement in Illinois, and she was certainly wanted to be buried there to remind us of the role of ordinary workers. And yet it's not a statue. It's a monument to the workers there, and she is buried with them, the mm-hmm. workers who had given their lives for the labor movement. People forget how foundational the mine workers were to every aspect of the labor movement. Their organization was critical, but she was sending a message that she wanted to be remembered for the rank and file, and she was a rank and file trade unionist.
Well, Rosemary, our time certainly went by quick.
Yes.
So I'm going to have to thank you for sharing your time and your wisdom with our listeners and bid you adieu.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1918. That was the evening that a series of explosions began at the T.A. Gillespie Company near Morgan, New Jersey. The explosions would destroy the plant and 300 buildings and kill an estimated 100 people. The world was embroiled in World War I. The United States had entered the global conflict the year before. The nation's factories were churning out munitions and other supplies for the war effort. On that fateful evening at Gillespie, workers were loading shells at the sprawling complex of 700 buildings that covered more than 2,000 acres. The initial explosion was likely an accident. Regardless, the explosion was so severe that it cut water lines to that part of the plant. Without water pressure, firefighters struggled to douse the flames. A chain reaction of explosions touched off as the fire spread in the plant. Houses in the nearby town shook from the massive explosions. Windows exploded and residents fled. Residents from three towns were evacuated due to the disaster. The New York Sun described the exodus as, quote, streams of human misery, mothers and fathers, frightened children clutching still more frightened dogs, old people tottering along with all the same dazed expressions on their faces, as if they scarcely realized what had happened. When the fire was finally put out, nearly half of the plant's buildings were destroyed. It was impossible to say exactly how many workers were killed, so bad was the carnage. Two members of the U.S. Coast Guard died responding to the disaster. The disaster was then compounded when a flu epidemic swept through the residents evacuated from nearby towns. The death toll and misery from these tragic events mounted even higher.
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe on your favorite podcast app, and even better, you can like us in your podcast app and pass it along. You can be part of Labor History Today by reading a labor history item. Just shoot us a note, laborhistorytoday@gmail.com. Labor History Today is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, working people's voices, broadcasting worldwide 24 hours a day. You can find out more at laborradionetwork.org, where there are links to more than 70 labor radio and podcast shows. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Evan Papp, Jessica Pozak, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and healthy, but do keep making history.